Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So a warm welcome to John Sharkey. Tonight's webinar is on myofascial trigger points and biotin-integrity-informed touch. And John is going to be coming back next week and giving a three-part course series, which is open for registration now. John's been with us many times talking about biotin integrity, fascia and body work, and his first assessment course with us earlier in this lockdown period was very popular on assessment, and hoping to see some of the faces from that course back on this one this evening. John, you're an exercise physiologist. You teach, you have your own college with that shirt, NTC in Ireland, with a master's program in neuromuscular therapy, you've contributed to a number of books, and you have your own book on dry needling for trigger points, and so your knowledge on trigger points is very, very good, one of the best in the world, I understand. So I'm excited because neuromuscular therapy was part of my degree with Dr. Leon Chaito and others back in 2001, so I'm very eager to learn more tonight, John, about how biotin integrity knowledge and an understanding can inform the way that we go about treating trigger points and approaching the assessment and treatment of such. And you're going to lead us through tonight what you're going to cover in the three parts coming up starting next week. And this course, like the first one, is at a very reasonable price of £60 for those of you that are interested. It'll be, that works out, at £20 a session. And they're roughly about an hour long, and they're very packed with information. So you can watch the recordings over and over again and unpack all the information and try it in your practice and with your colleagues. So yeah, another exciting evening, and I look forward to your presentation, John. Is there anything I've missed out? You also do the plastination and human cadaveric teal dissections. You do lots of things, don't you, John?
Yeah, I mean, I can get into some of that background now in a couple of minutes' time for people who do not know who I am. And I suppose in many ways, part of tonight's overall objective is to really introduce the course and to invite people to come and take a look. And perhaps after this evening, for those people who have given us their time, perhaps you'll share the link with friends and colleagues who you know are operating in the field of pain, particularly chronic pain, unresolved pain issues. Because some people may not know what myofascial trigger points are, or they may not know who John Sharkey is. So this is an opportunity really for us to put the information out there, give a small flavor and a taste of what we will cover in these three sessions that are to follow tonight. So from that viewpoint, I think it should be informative in terms of if you're already dealing with myofascial trigger points, it'll help you to perhaps maybe have a different vision, a different set of explanations. And also, as we come into session three, which is really session four, the third session, because next week is session one, we'll say, so this is just the overview. And then it will also provide some demonstrations of touch therapy interventions that would be suitable for the treatment of myofascial trigger points. So one of the things I like to encourage people to do during these Zoom type sessions would be to please feel free to ask a question whenever you wish. We have the chat opened, so of course you can put questions in there, and I'll certainly do my best to keep an eye on questions that come in, and if it's pertinent, then we'll answer the question as they arise, or we might, you know, put them aside for a short while and then come back to them. But I really do want this to be as close to the real thing. In other words, it's real time, and you're listening to me right now. And as you listen to me, if there's a question that comes to mind, please feel free to ask it. You don't have to wait until the very end, although we will do some questions and answers at the very end as well. Keep in mind as well that everything that I tell you could be wrong. That is the nature of science. And what we do is we look at the available information to hand, and then we come to conclusions based upon the probabilities that that science and those particular facts present to us. And so in the world of myofascial trigger points, there are individuals who do not believe in myofascial trigger points. There are individuals who do not believe in the postural model. In other words, if you've got rounded shoulders or if you have a scoliosis, they don't believe that that has any major effect in terms of generating pain or changes in sensations. And there have been articles written on those very topics and produced in several different journals. I am a person who believes in the musculoskeletal model and the postural model. A musculoskeletal, very reductionist term. Of course, we include all of the tissues within that phrase. So I believe that if you were to go out tomorrow and wear two different shoes on each foot, one with a heel raise and the other flat, and just walk around for a few hours, I think your body will begin to tell you that there's issues in terms of how you're dealing with the forces, because those forces ultimately will result in a strain. Stress in itself is not necessarily bad for you, but if we constantly have stress upon stress upon stress, then we lead towards a scenario where you're beginning to strain the body, because we're not giving ourselves the opportunity to be able to address the stress issue and either create an adaptation or recover from the stress. So stress can be good for us, but too much stress, hence the term repetitive strain injury, it leads to strain. And we need to give ourselves the opportunity to be able to recover from that. Otherwise, it's going to leak out somewhere in your system. And of course, I'm going to be talking about tensegrity generally and biotensegrity specifically. And I'm also going to introduce the term fasciotegrity, which is a term that both myself and my friend and colleague, Joanne Avison, brought to the table because of the focus on this connective tissue called fascia. And without fascia, there would be no body. So fasciotegrity, the integrity of the fascial system, is paramount in terms of communication and in terms of continuity, in terms of connectivity. That's hugely important. So we'll talk a little bit about tensegrity and biotensegrity and how that influences the way in which we work. Because the one thing, let me see, we have a tensegrity here. The one thing we know about this is a model of tensegrity, by the way. This is the icosahedron, which is a particular shape that supports life. Any other shape doesn't seem to support life, but the icosahedron seems to be the underlying principle of any cellular network. And so when we look at this architectural shape, this architectural makeup, we see that now we'll go into this in a bit more detail at a later stage, but at any stage, if we try to create motion or movement by applying a force or introducing a force into this structure, you see that it just doesn't move the local area, but it moves on a global basis. So this is a really nice way of explaining to patients and explaining to people generally how movement in one part of the body is either as a result of the entire body or has an effect on the entire body. So it really is nigh impossible to be able to have movement that is isolated to one part of the body. It is a whole body experience, and every cell is involved in that motion. So that's an important aspect to realize. Having said that, in terms of treatment, what you'll find is that in a biotensegrity model, and remember, you are a tensegrity, a living tensegrity, therefore biotensegrity. And in the biotensegrity model, if you have an insult, some type of perturbation, and let's say we had 10 of these icosahedrons, 10 of these tensegrity models, and we had a machine that could apply an external force which would damage the tensegrity. So we've 10 of these, and we have a machine that can apply the exact same identical force to each of the 10 models. You'll find that they'll all break in a different way. They won't all break in the exact same place. And that's a really important point to be able to take away from tensegrity as a tensegrity principle. And that is that you could have 10 people all doing the same type of social activities, physical activities, training, sports, whatever the case may be. They're all eating the same type of foods. They're training on the same surfaces, etc. But yet one has a shoulder problem, one has a knee problem, one has a low back problem. And the question would be, well, why is that the case? And that's the case because in a living tensegrity scenario, the adaptations that occur and the pain problems that arise or the changes in sensation are going to be individualistic. In other words, they will come out in the biotensegrity in a different place for each individual. Now, one could argue that they're going to come out in the weakest part of the biotensegrity. So that would be down to that individual, and it would be down to their environment, it could be down to so many different variables that affect that individual. So you cannot say that just because people are sitting in chairs for long periods of time that everybody's going to have low back pain. You'll find that one person will have low back pain where another person might have a sore neck, another person might have it coming in their knee, but yet it's all related to the fact that they're sitting. So sitting is not a very good thing for us, certainly not for long periods of time. But you can't say that sitting causes low back pain. It may cause low back pain in one individual, but in another individual, believe it or not, it could even be the underlying cause of toothache. Would you believe that? So, and I'll try to put more meat on that particular skeleton for you as we go through the particular sessions. Because again, there's no point in just giving lip service to people to say, oh yeah, you've got pain in your shoulder, but really your shoulder's not where the problem is. You have to be able to explain it in a way that makes good sense. And hopefully I'm going to help you with the language and vocabulary to be able to do that with your patients and with your clients. So I might just do a small introduction for those people that don't know me, and then I'll come out of the presentation just to see if there are some questions. But remember, as I say, if anybody has any questions that you want to ask, if they're pertinent and immediate, please feel free to do that. You don't need to you don't need to wait until the end of the session. I'm also going to encourage you to have some type of fluid beside you so that you sip away as I'm chatting and talking, because that's a really healthy thing to do, and particularly in these COVID times, if somebody has been unfortunate enough to have taken the COVID into their nasopharynx, then you can wash it. You can wash it down into your stomach and let hydrochloric acid kill it. Mind you, it's not killing it because a virus is not alive in the first place. That's a conversation for another presentation. But it's a good thing to actually just to hydrate and to keep taking in little sips of fluid, maybe every 5 or 6 minutes. Right. So I think I'll go into share screen, and we might just go into a presentation mode. So let me just share my sound, optimize the. Okay. So it looks like we're good to go, if I'm not mistaken. Does that look good, Julian? Yeah? Excellent. So the title of the course is Treating Myofascial Pain with Biotensegrity Informed Touch. For anybody who knows me, you'll know that tensegrity and biotensegrity are central to everything I teach. Although sometimes I might not even mention the word biotensegrity within a presentation, but it should always be taken that biotensegrity is central to everything that I'm talking about, because we are tensegrities that breathe and that have a nervous system. So we are somewhat more complex than these nice little models that we show people. These are good. And these are our friend, but sometimes they can also cause problems for us, because some people oversimplify the model of tensegrity. And one of the problems with this type of model is that it really is truly made up of two individual things, one being an elastic band and the other being a piece of wood, where with the human form, we are one. we'll get to that, and we'll make a little bit more sense of that as the course progresses. So hi everybody, my name is John, and I'm a clinical anatomist, an exercise physiologist. A clinical anatomist is a person responsible for delivering and teaching the medical curriculum to undergraduate medical students, to dentists and others who come into medical colleges to get earn their degrees. And as such, I have to teach the syllabus of medical anatomy. Now, and that's exactly what I would do when I'm in that scenario. However, I teach a different type of anatomy, which I call anatomy for the 21st century, because believe it or not, we are teaching anatomy today the same way that we did, or the same way as early anatomists did back in the 1500s. And it hasn't really changed all that much. So we still talk about the biceps brachii, we talk about the tendinous inscriptions. All of that is still exactly the same. And I find that a little bit strange because, you know, when we look out onto the streets and the roads and we see automobiles driving by, and if you stop and think about the first form of transport, if you think about the first form of communication, and now look at our smartphones and see how things have moved on. And yet it would seem that in anatomy, we really haven't moved on in the same way. Surgical techniques have changed, and the equipment that they're using in surgery has changed. Much of the equipment that we're using in anatomy, scalpels and forceps and hemostats and others, they're all the same. Saws, there are some new modern pieces of equipment now because we use electricity. But having bone grinders, etc. But ultimately, the equipment is still the same. So the equipment is the same, and the way in which we're talking about anatomy is the same. And I find that really strange that we have not investigated the way in which we're talking about anatomy. I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but even the word fascia is a word that needs to be deconstructed. It needs to be, for me, it needs to almost be, you know, put to one side and let's come up with a new word, because fascia means to tie or to bind, or it means bandage. And really, how can we come up with an agreement with regards to the description of this ubiquitous connective tissue that is everywhere in the human body that we call fascia? So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to hang on to these old terms and make sense of them. And in fact, we can't come to an agreement. We can't make sense of them because it's not possible to make sense of a word that comes from, you know, maybe the 15th or 16th century. That's my opinion. I am associate editor of the Fascia Science and Clinical Applications section of the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapy. And in fact, I was just looking at some recent issues today, and there are a plethora of articles, research articles and investigations on the topic of myofascial trigger points. So really, it's rich with research related to fascia and related to myofascial trigger points. And I suppose I'm lucky in that regard. And of course, the reason I'm lucky in that regard is because of this man, my friend and colleague, who Julian mentioned at the very top of the presentation, and that is Dr. Leon Chaitow. I owe so much to Dr. Chaitow for the opportunities that he gave me, and hence my involvement in JBMT. This is a needle in our main thoroughfare in Dublin City in Ireland, and our county council built this in honour of my book, which was the book on dry needling for myofascial trigger points. So that's not true at all, but I have to make that story up because I have no idea why they put this needle in the centre of Dublin City. But this is where I'm from, and when the COVID-19 crisis is behind us, I encourage you all to come to Dublin and pay us a visit and take a look at this magnificent needle. You can stand back from it and just hold your fingers like this with the needle in the background. People do this all the time. They get a photograph taken as if you're holding it between your thumb and index finger. This is one of the books that I wrote, and of course, neuromuscularity and healing through trigger point therapy also with Dr. Devin Starlinall. And you know, in the first book there on the left-hand side, the concise book on neuromuscular therapy, this was the first book that did not use an X to identify a myofascial trigger point. And for those people who are familiar with myofascial trigger points, you may have seen charts or if you look at any textbook that's written on the topic, you'll see an X, which denotes where the location of the myofascial trigger point is. Now, I would encourage you to ignore the X. There were several reasons, which I'll explain on the course, as to why an X was used to kind of mark the spot for treating the myofascial trigger point. And it was really for doctors whose level of topographical anatomy or gross anatomy was not great. And so they needed a little bit of help in terms of being able to know where to treat. And part of that then was there was a hypothesis that myofascial trigger points, for the most part, would form in the very center of a muscle gaster. So a muscle gaster is the belly. So for instance, in my upper limb here, I can stick about two fingers in between the end of my muscle belly, my gaster, and where, and probably three fingers actually, to come up to the what classically people call the insertion. So from that viewpoint, this is all tendinous. And then this is where the muscle belly is located. In other words, this is where you find the reddish brown protein that we call muscle fibers. These guys that have evolved to be able to contract, and they offer us that particular speciality. And so the hypothesis was that as we follow nerves into this apparatus, the question would be, well, where would the nerve enter into a muscle like biceps brachialis or brachioradialis or any of these other muscles? Well, the idea was, of course, it would be through the path of least resistance, and the area of least resistance would have been seen as being the very center of the belly, and then it would make its way out. So basically where the X for the most part would appear was really on the center of the gaster, and therefore for a doctor, this is X marked where they would place a needle, a hypodermic needle, which would deliver a wet solution, something like lidocaine, and then they would inject into the muscle. So I really want to encourage you to ignore the X's if you're seeing these charts, because they really are not helpful. And in fact, I've met many people over the years who have said to me, oh, I had the patient in and I checked them for trigger points in the upper trapezius, and I'd say to them, can you show me where you looked? And they say, oh yeah, I looked right here where the X is on the chart. And you investigate, saying, did you check any other part of the muscle? And they go, no, why would I do that? I injected where the X was. And so you realize that the reason they didn't get a therapeutic response is because that's not where the myofascial trigger points were. And really injecting in there was of no earthly good. So it's really a very important point to make to you that as we go through this course, that we need to search the entire gaster of the muscle in order to be able to find where the myofascial trigger points are housed, and then we treat them there. This is the third edition of what are known as the Big Red Books, Myofascial Pain and Dysfunction, the Trigger Point Manuals. Volume 1 and 2 were huge sellers. And Dr. David Simons, you'll see Travell, Simons and Simons as the authors there. And Dr. Simons was working on the third edition, and he got sidetracked because Dr. Simons was very interested in what is termed global warming or climate change. And he started to investigate and research and survey that topic. And he was writing a book or compiling a book on that topic, which took him away from his focus on the third edition of this particular famous book. So unfortunately, we lost Dr. Simons before he got the chance to be able to produce a third volume. But really, Dr. Joe Donnelly was Dr. Simons' right-hand man. And Dr. Joseph Donnelly there, was responsible, along with several other of our colleagues, of putting together a third edition. And I'm very proud and very pleased to say that I contributed to this particular tome. And it's a big read. And you know, we discussed many different aspects of the textbook, and there were some things which they agreed with, some of the opinions I had, and then there were others that they didn't. So, for example, you'll see on the images used on the front cover, there are no X's. So that was fantastic that they agreed to remove the X's, similar to my book, in, which was published in 2008, Concise Book on Neuromuscular Therapy. However, one of the things that they didn't agree with was that I believe that we should constantly be referring to these entities in muscle tissue as myofascial trigger points. However, in the third edition of Myofascial Pain and Dysfunction, they decided to call them trigger points. My personal view on that is I think that that's a mistake, because again, I meet several different therapists and they tell me that they're working with trigger points. And when I investigate with them as to what they're actually working on and what their description of the trigger point is, I discover that what they're talking about and what I'm talking about are two very different things. So we have to discuss the pathophysiology and the etiology of the myofascial trigger point. In other words, what constitutes a myofascial trigger point? And during the course, I'm going to give you what is a new vision and a new explanation of the myofascial trigger point. And it really comes from the fact, less from the fact that I'm an exercise physiologist, I mean, that's going to be part of it, but a big influencing fact is that I'm a clinical anatomist. And I'll try to make sense of that as the course progresses. But for me, a myofascial trigger point is a particular entity, and understanding the pathophysiology of it really will inform you in terms of how you should go about treating these myofascial trigger points. So as I say, within the edition, they're called trigger points, but I really encourage you to ask, are we talking about the same thing? Because myofascial trigger points are what I treat, and that's basically what I talk about. And I do not use, let's say, for instance, with using needles, we're not going to be talking about using needles on this course, but in terms of dry needling or the use of needles, I only use needles for the treatment of myofascial trigger points. I don't use the needles for anything else.
John, could you clarify if you say that some of the people who, you know, in practice were saying they looked here, and they didn't look anywhere else, and this description between what they use in Travell and Simons and Simons' book called Trigger Points, what you've just been talking about basically, and you call them myofat, you said they're two different things. People are talking about treating different things. But I mean, I was taught by Leon, and I'm confused, so I'm sure maybe some other people are confused. What do you mean by they're two different things?
Okay, so it's a huge question. Believe it or not, we could spend hours just going through that as well, because it's historical, and I think that that's very important. In other words, people need to know the history. I'm dealing with somebody, actually, by the way, in Latvia currently, a doctor in Latvia, and in the conversation, there's also an acupuncturist involved. And in fact, I was even having a conversation in the last couple of months with one of the major insurance companies in the UK called Baylin's. And I was talking to David Baylin in relation to dry needling, for example. And it is, you know, at the end of the conversation, you know, he was saying to me, my goodness, John, he said, you know, I didn't know any of these, you know, these differences, these differentiations. So let me just explain them just a little bit for you. What you're looking at on the screen, I was going to use this particular slide for a different reason, but I'll use it just because of the question that came up, which I think is fantastic. I love when questions are raised like that. So to your left-hand side, you can see Dr. Arthur Steindler. Now, Arthur Steindler was a person who used a term trigger point. And in Europe, we also had other people, other doctors, who were treating what they referred to as pain points at the time. But I think in looking back over the documentation and the explanations, I think that they were also talking about myofascial trigger points, but they didn't call them myofascial trigger points. So for instance, in Germany, excuse my German, I think they were referring to them as things like muscular harden. In other words, hard aspects or hard nodules that people could feel under their fingertips within muscles. So what were these little hard nodules that they were feeling? And as I say, I think based upon the descriptions and so on, they were really talking about myofascial trigger points. However, there are other points in muscles that can be a source of pain and that can also refer pain, but they're not myofascial trigger points. Within Chinese medicine, they have what they refer to often as ashi points. And ashi points are tender points, are also not myofascial trigger points. So somebody could be talking about a trigger point, but they may not necessarily be talking about what I'm talking about, which is a myofascial trigger point. And a myofascial trigger point has to be differentiated based upon its pathophysiology. In other words, we have to understand what a myofascial trigger point is in the first place in order to be able to differentiate it from something else. So David Simons, Professor David Simons, is in the center there with myself with a very tanned looking face. And he always suffered with trigger points up on his shoulder, incidentally. I was giving him a little treatment in between presentations there. So that's Professor David Simons. And then to the right-hand side, you can see Dr. Janet Travell standing alongside President John F. Kennedy. She was the first female physician in the White House. And Dr. Travell was teaching doctors how to treat what she termed as myofascial trigger points. Because remember, Arthur Steindler had already coined trigger points. So she wanted to differentiate between these other painful points or trigger points, and she wanted to associate the relationship with the fascial system. So she specifically called them myofascial trigger points to differentiate them from any other type of trigger point. The other quick point I'm going to make to you is many people that I meet, I can only talk about my own experiences, and particularly acupuncturists, believe that they invented the term dry needling. The term dry needling was coined by Dr. Janet Travell. Now, why did she coin the phrase and why was there a necessity to do so? Dr. Travell was teaching doctors how to treat myofascial trigger points using needles. The needles that she was using were hypodermic needles. These are needles that are used for delivering some type of wet solution, which would be a numbing solution like lidocaine. And so once the myofascial trigger point was located, the doctor would pop the hypodermic needle in and then would administer the local anesthetic. However, to be using hypodermic needles with a wet solution would be very, very costly and also wouldn't have made any sense, because many of the people that were on the courses who were training, they themselves did not have myofascial trigger points, but they were being shown how to locate them and how to administer the needle. So what Dr. Travell did was she coined the phrase dry needling so that she could differentiate between the delivery of a wet solution as opposed to using just the hypodermic needle for training purposes. What also happened then shortly after that was another scientist by the name of Baldry went and did investigations. He thought to himself, I wonder, is there a difference between using a hypodermic needle with wet solution and just using a solid filiform needle, an acupuncture needle? I wonder, would there be a difference between the two? And so he did research on that, and we discovered that there was no difference in terms of therapeutic output. The therapeutic output was really very, very similar. I mean, the fact that you're administering a small local anesthetic gave, you know, some small advantages in terms of numbing the area. However, really, there was no additional benefit when you think of the costs involved. There was no additional benefit in terms of therapeutic output. But you might ask yourself the question then, why would doctors use, you know, wet solutions when we know that a solid dry needle does the same thing? Well, the insurance companies will not pay for dry needling in North America. They will only pay if a doctor is injecting a wet solution. So there's your bottom line. At the end of the day, the doctors who are treating myofascial trigger points with injections will only use hypodermic needles with a wet solution, otherwise they won't get paid. So that gives you some overview of the history of where these terms have come from and why people were using different terms. So as I say, as we get into the course, because I don't want to give too much away, Julian, at this stage, but as we get into the course, I'll get into the pathophysiology and I will explain the differences then between the myofascial trigger point and just a tender point or pain point. I may talk a little bit about it this evening, but obviously I'll be limited in terms of how much I can explain. One of the things I like to mention to people is that Dr. David Simons was the first human being to go into space officially. A lot of people don't actually know that, but here is an image of Dr. Simons, which is the first selfie taken in space. This is a photograph he took of himself in his space capsule, and you'll see that it was this particular edition of Life was 1957. And although I haven't seen the program myself, I believe that NOVA, PBS and NOVA, have done a documentary on these early pioneers to come into space. And this was in 2016, I believe. And it was the first time that I'm aware of that they actually gave credit to Professor David Simons. So, because a lot of people think that it was a Russian cosmonaut who was the first human to officially go into space, and it wasn't. Yuri Gagarin was the first human to orbit the Earth twice. So there's David all kitted out in his spacesuit, and there's some magnificent photographs inside that I have a copy of it here, and showing storms forming over North America, actually over the South Americas, I think Brazil, etc. And photographs that he took. So, and that in itself is another amazing story. It's actually how he met Dr. Janet Travell, because she came down to one of the air bases to give a presentation, and that was it. That was the beginning of a 40-year professional relationship between himself and Dr. Janet Travell. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be informed by biotensegrity, and that is the father of biotensegrity on the left-hand side, Dr. Stephen Levin. And myself and Dr. Levin go back many, many years. We can't really remember how many years we know each other, but to the right-hand side, that is a younger version of Dr. Levin. And there he is with Dr. Janet Travell. So we met each other many, 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 many years ago. And I was influenced very much by his vision. And it's so much matched with what I was thinking and what I was seeing myself. So I think it's a, and of course, biotensegrity in itself has become much bigger than Dr. Levin. He says that himself, because now there are more people coming in from different disciplines and different scientific disciplines who are able to inform us in ways that one individual could never do on his own. So now biotensegrity is really growing and has huge acceptance on an international basis within the various different medical disciplines and in the human movement disciplines and in bodywork therapy or touch therapy disciplines as well. So that's really exciting. Okay. Oh, and that's just a little photograph of myself with Dr. Chaito with Dr. Simons as well. Here's then to take it into the tensegrity or living tensegrity concept. This is my icosahedron baby. This particular image I love because we are biotensegrities, and as such we where's my little, so this is a tensegrity model, but if you look at it you'll see that there's another tensegrity model inside. And in fact I just realized I've made a small mistake. I think I have, thanks to Joanne Avison there. Sorry Joanne, I think I'm right in saying it was actually Amanda who did the icosahedron baby, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was. Anyway, it's my baby. It's my icosahedron baby. But I think it was actually Amanda Williams who did the artwork for me. Joanne did artwork on something else, but maybe Joanne can remind me just so I can get the reference on that correct. I think it was Amanda Williams who did the artwork. But this is a tensegrity, and then you can see inside the red one, which is a tensegrity within a tensegrity. So this little tensegrity model was made for me by my friend and colleague Graham Scar, and that really sums up what we are. We are tensegrity within tensegrity within tensegrities. So one has to appreciate that from a cellular level, and we are built from the cellular level up, from an evolutionary viewpoint. We all started as simple bacteria, and now we have evolved into Homo sapiens. And so we are built from the ground up, from the cellular, the micro to the macro. And from that viewpoint, it means that every single cell in the human body is a miniature tensegrity. And then, of course, we are bio because we're living, breathing tensegrities. And so the principles of tensegrity are true at the micro level, and then they're true at the macro level. So, for example, if I was to ask you a question, if I take a tensegrity model, and if I was to hold two of the struts or two of the bars, and if I was to pull them in opposite directions, what do you think would happen within the tensegrity? If I pull them in both directions, would the tensegrity expand, or would the tensegrity stiffen? If I was to take the tensegrity and if I was to compress it, in other words, push my hands together, would the tensegrity collapse? Would it loosen up a little bit, or would it stiffen? And the answer to both of those questions is it would stiffen. And so, and this is without a nervous system. So I want you to kind of think about that and keep that in your mind, because there are fundamental underlying principles which people just don't know, they don't understand, or if they have heard it, they've forgotten about it and left it down there at the microscopic level, and perhaps think that it doesn't actually exist at the macro level, where in fact that's not the case. So when you try to lengthen or indeed make a change in the shape of the icosahedron, it actually stiffens. So you need to ask yourself the question, is that therapeutically what you wanted to do with the tissue? Did you want the tissue to stiffen? If stiffening is what you wanted to do, then that's great. Then try to make it expand, try to stretch it, if that's what you want to do. If that's the outcome, the therapeutic outcome. Most people do not understand what the physiological outcome of doing certain things in the human body is. And I'm hopefully going to, as I say, help you with that. So be aware that you are the icosahedron baby. And of course, we grow and we grow and we develop, but we are icosahedron within icosahedron. So we are self-assembled and we are self-organized and we grow ourselves. That's the major point to be made in that particular slide.
John,
can I ask you a quick... Oh, sorry. I was going to ask you a quick question, John. Well, there's a question from Summer, actually, about, she's saying, it's taking a step back a bit, curious if the introduction of a liquid into the tissues as opposed to a dry needle also makes a difference in how it could change the tensegrity of the fascia, apart from the numbing effect of the lidocaine. I'm interested in this because...
Oh, John, you muted yourself.
You muted yourself, John, and I'm going to come out of the presentation. I think it'd be better to make this conversation if I stop the share for a moment and just use these screens. Is that a bit better, Julian, I think?
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Did you hear the first bit about that?
I kind of heard some of it. Yeah, just if you would repeat the question for us, that'd be great.
Okay. Curious, this is from Summer. Curious if the introduction of a liquid into the tissues as opposed to a dry needle also makes a difference in how it could change the tensegrity of the fascia, apart from the effect of the lidocaine, for example. And I was just saying that I'm quite interested in this because Michel Audin, sort of the natural birth pioneer, used to advocate the use of sterilized water, injecting sterilized water during labor, which was very effective in relieving some pain. So I'm just interested in that, what you think about that.
Yeah, and again, I think that that's another area that could be just a focus conversation for an evening. Having said that, one can have hypotheses in terms of how in introducing additional fluids into the internal environment of a muscle tissue, how that would affect the muscle tissue. But of course, we need to have specific research to be able to inform us. That there's nothing wrong with having a hypothesis, by the way. Everything has to start with the hypothesis. And if there is no opportunity to be able to do specific in vivo research, then one is left with basically working upon sound physiology and sound anatomy and coming to a conclusion. So at the end of the day, if you're going to inject a liquid or a fluid into a system, into a tissue, then that liquid or fluid is going to permeate into those tissues and will be trapped, if that's a good word, it will be contained or trapped by the fascial matrix. So that it, and depending on the fascial matrix of the specific area that it's in the body, will allow it to extravate. It'll allow it to move from one place to another based upon the specific anatomy, not just the morphology, but the actual specific anatomy. So for instance, let's say somebody damaged the bladder and urine escaped from the bladder. You will find that that urine can make its way down to the lateral aspect of your thigh. And it makes its way down to the lateral aspect of your thigh and stops there based upon the anatomy of the fascia, because the fascia basically evaginates or turns back on itself to create little pockets. And so, again, it's why if somebody, for instance, has a rectal cancer, the surgeon can go in, depending on the timing of where the person is in terms of stages of the cancer, and can remove a specific amount of fascia, and then that is it. The cancer is now taken out of the body, and the chance that there is, you know, it's now contained. So it depends on where either a liquid or indeed a cancer or a bacteria gets into the body. So for instance, again, I think I mentioned this the other day, we were doing something, I was doing a presentation and we were talking about the buccopharyngeal fascia here in the cervical or cervical neck, as the Americans say. So you have a fascia that goes from internal carotid artery to internal carotid artery, and it's called the alar fascia. And really, you know, fluids and bacteria can't get through that. It's a very thickened fascia. However, to the buccopharyngeal fascia, it's a kind of a more loosely arranged fascia. And so bacteria and fluids can actually make their way down into the mediastinum. And that's how it basically spreads. So fluids can, if you inject a fluid into a muscle tissue, you know, it's going to have an effect. And so think about it. I mean, a fluid dynamic, and it's very different to lymphatic or to venal or arterial fluids. That's a different model. It needs a different set of explanations, because we're injecting an external fluid into the environment, and that's going to create expansion in the tissue and probably some structural tissue damage as well. So just because you got a therapeutic benefit of reducing pain doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing. It might have been a good thing in the short term. In other words, in this case, John, you mentioned it was to do with birthing. Well, if during the birthing process, if the woman feels that a reduction in pain was a good thing, well, then everybody applauds the reduction in pain. But as they say in the legal profession, no good deed goes unpunished. So one then has to truly understand what the mechanisms were that led to a reduction in pain. So for instance, somebody could say to me that they have a pain in a particular body part, and I sever the nerve and now they've no pain. So was that a good thing? So well, you know, maybe or maybe not. And it's hence why the medical profession, for example, if I was to pick a particular population, I'd pick nurses. Nurses tend to be a population that suffer with particular kind of neuropathies more than other populations, particularly relating to the upper limb or going up into the head and neck. And oftentimes, if you get talking to the nursing population, they'll tell you that they went in to have some of the nerves cauterized in an effort to get rid of the pain, you know, which seems, you know, pretty barbaric to me. And I would much prefer that people did not go and have the nerves cauterized, because you have to try to listen to a person's story. That's so essential. And it's the one thing that we touch therapists do, which I think we do much better than doctors, because if you go for a 2 o'clock appointment to your local doctor, and now this is pre-COVID, I think things are going to change now, but typically you could have seen eight or nine other people sitting in that waiting room that had an appointment for almost the same time, you know, it was 2 o'clock or whatever the case may be. We don't do that in touch therapy. We wouldn't have six people arriving to us for a 2 o'clock appointment. Our appointments, generally speaking, I think for the most part, are probably a 1 hour appointment. So we have time to listen to a person, to listen to their story. And that really helps you to be able to determine what is the underlying cause, which was the next slide that I was pretty much going to be getting to be able to say, well, you know, what is it that can cause pain? And I want you to also understand, by the way, that in my presentations, I don't just talk about pain. I talk about changes in sensations, because myofascial trigger points cause changes in sensations. And in fact, excuse me, myofascial trigger points mimic everything. This is such an important point to make to you. Myofascial trigger points mimic everything. They mimic toothache, they mimic low back pain, medial epicondylitis, cervical radiculopathy, whatever issue you want to talk about, runner's knee, plantar fasciitis, myofascial trigger points mimic all of these things. And you will have patients coming into your clinic, or they'll have been to other therapists' clinic and they've been treated with no resolution. So, you know, I don't believe that you can treat them doing exactly what the last therapist did and expect to get a different result. You have to have a different vision, a different explanation, and you have to listen to their story so that you can be able to make an informed choice to say, well, here's what I think is going on. What are the perpetuating factors that are involved here? And sometimes it is about treating the myofascial trigger points, but then it's about understanding what the perpetuating factors are, because if you don't change the perpetuating factors, then you're simply going to have a reintroduction of the myofascial trigger points. Because in some cases, myofascial trigger points are in fact functional. So they're not always necessarily the evil, bad enemy, although they can, you know, be the precursor to pain, which is not pleasant. But it, you know, taking away the myofascial trigger point doesn't always guarantee a resolution of the problem, because we have to understand what the problem is and we have to change that, whatever that perpetuating factor is. And then you find that the myofascial trigger points are no longer required, or they're no longer needed by the body, or they're no longer perceived to be needed. And therefore, we don't have the issue. And that all came from a question relating to fluids being introduced into the body.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, John.
But fluid dynamics is a different conversation, because fluid dynamics in terms of lymphatic fluids, interstitial fluids, venous and arterial fluids, and I mentioned this, I think, the other day as well. I don't know whether, Julian, it was when I was talking to yourself, but I think I mentioned the vena comitans, and many people don't know about vena comitans, that, for instance, if you look at my upper limb, we have a main artery running down my upper limb, but what you actually have either side of the artery are two veins. And I don't think a lot of anatomy textbooks make that clear enough to people, that you have an artery accompanied by two veins. Now, why did Mother Nature put a vein either side of the artery? Mother Nature did that. I'm speaking on behalf of Mother Nature now. I don't know when she made me her spokesperson. But as you get this pulsation through the via arterial flow, you get this wave form through the arteries, and it basically helps the venous flow return back up the body. So the body, our nature, doesn't waste energy, or tries not to waste energy. I mean, sometimes we can look at the thermodynamics of the human body and we say that 80% of the energy that we produce becomes heat. And you might think to yourself, well, that's very wasteful. It's actually not wasteful at all, because the production of that heat aids in both metabolism and aids in the physiology. But one just needs to understand what it's doing. So you'll find that you can move easier when you're a little bit hotter, as opposed to when you're really cold, you find it harder to move. So the fact that we're producing energy and creating heat, you know, begets for smoother movement and easier movement. So that's part of the laws of thermodynamics. Are there any other quick questions, Julian or John, that I need to?
There is, yeah. We're about 5 to 8, so just to let you know, John. And there's one which could be good to get to. I know answer to part of it. Do you treat myofascial trigger points just with dry needles? I know that you don't.
No. Fingers and thumbs, and that's what we'll be talking about. To be honest, I would encourage people to, first of all, move towards fingers and thumbs, digits, or even an elbow, and then move towards using the solid filiform needle, the dry needle, because it simply, you know, ends up saving your fingers and thumbs, particularly if people are going about using their fingers and thumbs in a way that is not, you know, particularly good. You know, if we were in person with each other, I'd be able to pay more attention to being able to correct people when I see them. Definitely people could be using their fingers and thumbs in a more efficient way. And certainly the use of a needle saves your fingers and thumbs.
And the first part to this actually was, how do you feel and recognize a myofascial trigger point? So I don't know if you've got time to cover that tonight.
So what we need to do is we need to come and join me next week. And the week after, and the week after. So I'll cover all of that in those three sessions. I think that's, you know, part of the magic that you're going to get, you know, when you come onto the course. And hopefully the price of 60 euros will encourage you. We're trying our best to support and facilitate individuals who have had their clinic closed for some time. And if you're anything like what's happening here in Ireland, my goodness, the feedback we're getting from therapists is incredible, because if people didn't think that touch therapy was important in the community, we have people almost breaking the doors down to get into their therapist, which is so reassuring. And it's fantastic to hear people, you know, report this back to us, because I think that touch therapists, whatever your stripe, I know I talk from the viewpoint of neuromuscular therapy, but whatever your stripe, you're playing an important role in your community. And I think that's become more evident than ever before because of this coronavirus. So, you know, there's obviously going to be some silver lining in this dark cloud that has hung over us now for some months. And bear in mind as well, by the way, that there is a vaccination for the coronavirus. In other words, it's not that they have to construct one right now, they have it. The issue is that it has to be administered in a way that is safe, and that is going to take some time to work out the dosage, because you know that some people sign up to participate in these trials. And so it's the feedback and the learned process from the dosage. They've got to get the dosage right, and so far they haven't got that right. So you know, it could be, you know, another 10 to 12 months, but there is a resolution or solution to this problem coming down the road. So that is, you know, positive light at the end of that tunnel. So please join me on the course, and we'll certainly go through that type of information, which is again critical in terms of being able to treat the myofascial trigger point, because you have to be able to identify them and you have to be able to find them. So I'll show you some beautiful neuromuscular techniques to be able to locate these little devils. Now, they're not always little devils, by the way. Sometimes there's a functional aspect to a myofascial trigger point. And so we need to be able to have the ability to, through informed knowledge, whether this is something that we need to remove or whether we don't treat it, but that we actually treat the perpetuating factors that are causing the myofascial trigger point. I will say to you as well, by the way, that you don't really need to be worried about removing myofascial trigger points, because if they are functional, they will literally be back within minutes. Within minutes, they will be back. There has been research carried out on individuals who were completely asymptomatic. In other words, their forearms were checked for myofascial trigger points. They had no pain. They were reporting, you know, no incidents whatsoever. And they were also assessed for myofascial trigger points or tender points or pain points. They had none of these things. And they were then included in the research project. And all they simply did was, from an ergonomic viewpoint, they were working with a mouse on their computers, and they simply put them onto kind of a thicker pad so that it was an awkward position for the wrist. And these people developed myofascial trigger points within 8 minutes. So myofascial trigger points can form very, very quickly. And if they're forming as a result of a requirement in the body, in other words, it's a functional adaptation. If you take away the myofascial trigger point, it'll be back within no time whatsoever. So let's just say, for instance, somebody had osteoporosis or osteopenia, osteoporosis as an example. Internally, the body might be saying, we need some additional stiffness in this area to support this particular region of the body. Let's say it's the lumbar region. So if you go in and you feel that it's a little bit hard and indurated and there's some myofascial trigger points there, and you think, oh, it would be nice to treat them and to reduce some of the tonation. Will you go in and you treat them, and you know, so you now take away the myofascial trigger points and you soften that connective tissue? Is that a good thing? Well, the body was saying it needed additional stiffness in that area because it needed to protect the vertebral bodies. Now, through assessment and interviewing and talking to this individual, you should become suspicious that the underlying cause might well be osteoporosis. But let's just say, for instance, it gets past you and you didn't work that out. The chances are, the idea, of course, would be that you make sure you tell your patients that they need to take it very easy in the, you know, the first few minutes, having finished the treatment. In other words, don't just go running down the stairs. Make sure that they're holding onto a banisters if there's a stairway in your premises, and make sure they take a number of minutes before they begin to tackle the stairs. And believe me, in those couple of minutes, those myofascial trigger points will actually be back in place. So if the person comes back to you the next time, and here we again have tight low back muscles and the trigger points are back again, you have to be asking yourself the question, well, why are the myofascial trigger points returning? One is that you either didn't treat the right area, or number two, the myofascial trigger points are functional. They're there for a reason. And the way to remove those myofascial trigger points is less by treating the actual myofascial trigger points themselves, but treating the underlying cause. In other words, you know, this person might have osteoporosis. Well, then the osteoporosis has to be treated. And you'll find that by treating the osteoporosis, which is a medical treatment, of course, and by treating the osteoporosis, and that might involve physical activity as well, then you find that the myofascial trigger points will simply disappear. I hope that makes sense, but I've said it quite quickly. But the beauty of this is you can go back and you can listen to it over and over again. Okay, how are we doing for time? I mean, I could, you know, obviously we could talk forever in relation to this. What I'd like to do is I'd like to learn a little bit more about the participants, a little bit more about what you're doing. You know, even I'm not quite sure if it's possible to send in an email to Embodied Health in advance, just so that I can be sure that I'm going to embrace everybody and embrace everybody's needs. I'm fairly confident that a lot of what I'm going to be teaching you is going to be new for you. In other words, these are new concepts and a new vision in terms of myofascial trigger points. I will perhaps maybe just share these last two images, if you'll allow me to do that, Julian.
Yeah, sure.
That sound okay?
People could type their modality if you're planning to attend the course starting next week, and you care to share which modality you're practicing, and so John can get an idea of what everyone is practicing. That's an important piece of information, and whether perhaps you're new to treating myofascial trigger points or you are looking to advance your existing knowledge. So yeah, we have Bowen, craniosacral.
Excellent.
Bowen again, Rolfa. I'll just leave that for a few minutes and I'll tell you, John, what's come back while you do those sharp slides.
Well, just very quickly, I just want to share this image. So here what we have is we have a light microscope image of muscle fibers, or, you know, myofibrils. And basically what you see here is you see a nerve. And in the image that was captured, we can count what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And there seems to be another one going off to the right-hand side. So let's just say, for example, this muscle that we're looking at, let's say it had 250,000 muscle fibers contained within the muscle. Let's just say. If a stimulus is provided by this nerve, how many muscle fibers would you expect to contract within that muscle? So just for tonight, I'm making up the number. I'm saying there's 250,000 muscle fibers contained within the muscle. How many muscle fibers do you think would contract? That's the question. I don't know if I'd answer that for you tonight or whether we should leave that till next week. Let's see how excited people get, and maybe you can blackmail me into answering it. But the reason I'm asking you the question is to see, you know, test yourself. What do you know? And then, of course, I want to try to, you know, put it into context and say, well, why would it be important that you do know these things? I don't know if people have heard of the all or none principle. If you have heard of the all or none principle, what does it mean? And how does it inform you? What is the all or none principle? If we go to the next image, this is a myofascial trigger point. And what you're seeing, in fact, in the lower half of the slide is you're seeing a novel piece of equipment that was invented by a member of a team in the National Institutes of Health, which was headed up by my friend and colleague, Dr. Jay Shah. And this is basically a microdialysis piece of equipment. And it was just amazing when I was talking with Dr. Shah. He took a solid needle, typical acupuncture needle, and using a laser, they basically burned two holes into the needle. So think about how small an acupuncture needle is. And this is using, you know, nanotechnology. They were able to burn two holes in the needle, and they were able to then cut the bottom of the needle and put in a small diaphragm. And what they did was they used ultrasonography to be able to locate and identify the myofascial trigger point. And then what they did was they brought the needle in and they perforated the myofascial trigger point. And on perforating the myofascial trigger point, instantly, they flushed a solution down one of the channels of the needle and sucked the solution back up again in the other channel. In other words, what they did was they were able to collect a sample of the chemical milieu of the myofascial trigger point. And they were able to then investigate, well, what do myofascial trigger points contain? And you'll be amazed about what it is that they do contain. So myofascial trigger points have also been suggested as being the very earliest signs of cancers. Now, I'm just putting that out there as a proposition. It was suggested by somebody. In other words, the cancers have to start somewhere, and that it could be that myofascial trigger points are the precursors. In other words, that they create the type of environment that then begets the next stage or next phase, etc. Because these are have high concentrations of neurotoxins, bradykinins, phosphate P, and so on, lots of other noxious chemicals, which can change the local activity and the overall environment of the connective tissues. And in fact, if you see some of these little lines here, see those little fellas there? Well, that looks like there's a space between those two fibers, and it's what we call a virtual space. It's what we call the critical fiber distance. So in other words, there needs to be that space between the fibers, although it's not a real space in the sense that it's empty. It's not actually empty. But having said that, it shouldn't have these little fellas here. So they are a sticky protein called chitin. And what tends to happen with with these little small fibers is that they can become damaged. And so the outer wall becomes damaged, and then chitin escapes out into this critical fiber distance. And as you can see over here, it begins to cause coagulation, and that stickiness then begins to cause adhesions. It adheres. So now, instead of getting a natural gliding motion of fibers, what happens now is they begin to become adhered, and now they're moving, you know, like this. So they don't have the same autonomy that they would have had beforehand. And so this is going to interfere with the natural movement of the muscle tissue, and it's also going to, even at that microscopic level, it's going to begin to interfere with range of motion and so on and so forth. So it's really interesting. But as I say, this was work done by Dr. Jay Shah, who works for the National Institutes of Health, and you can't really get better research than research from the National Institutes of Health, which incidentally has a new director now, who's Helen Langevin, who herself was an acupuncturist. So Helen Langevin, who is the director now, and has tens of millions at her disposal in terms of research funding. It's amazing that she has that position. Congratulations to Ms. Langevin. It's a fantastic achievement. Okay, how are we doing?
So good. Yeah, we've got some people who are very new to myofascial trigger points and are interested to learn and hope to apply it in their work, and others that wish to advance, which is quite predictable. But yeah, Bowen, craniosacral, Rolfers, PTs with quite a lot of experience wanting to learn the application of the biotensegrity aspect to their work. One person who's already dry needling. Yeah, those. And then on Facebook, we've got Bowen and physio, manual therapist, somatic movement re-education person.
Excellent. Well, one of the little things I'll say to you before I leave you tonight, in case people do not get to join us, is that everything you do in terms of touch therapy needs to be slow. It needs to be somewhat delicate. You should really avoid gung-ho, stick your elbows in, stick your thumbs in. That really, the older you get, believe me, you'll realize that less is more. And when we truly understand the biotensegral nature of the human body, when we truly understand neurophysiology, you'll begin to realize that. And in fact, there are new research papers. Look out for Piezo 1 and 2. So for instance, you can put those terms into your search engines, Piezo 1 and 2. And what you're going to find, in fact, is that all of the latest research is telling us that it's light touch that resonates with the body's physiology. So going gung-ho is generally speaking not the best approach, and probably is a little bit hit and miss. The body loves subtle touch, and go in gently and slowly, and have a conversation with the body where you're seeking permission to go a little bit deeper. And if the body wants you to go deeper, it will allow you to go deeper. If it doesn't want you to go deeper, it will stiffen somewhat, and it'll give you that feedback to say, no, I'm not happy with this. And as long as you're not doing something that's damaging, then maybe just hold that position, just so that the body can really get a sense of what's happening. And then maybe it will lower its sympathetic tone and say, no, there's nothing untoward happening here. And that will allow for a rise in parasympathetic tone. And suddenly you'll find your fingers getting in deeper. This idea, because myofascial trigger points from a depth viewpoint could be superficial or they could be deep. It's very hard sometimes to be able to know where exactly this thing is in terms of depth. So you don't have to worry too much about that. If you have the right conversation with the human body, the body will allow you in and will allow you down to the correct depth.
John, we have a participant who's diligently flagged something here. This presentation is for therapists, but of course, when we're working with clients, it's Hannah said, because of the strong, overwhelming research on nocebo, of course, it's very unhelpful to tell a client that, and John was not suggesting that we tell our clients that trigger points are precursors to cancer and get them worrying. This is for us as clinicians to note that information.
No, obviously at the end of the day, people have to be very careful about the kind of language that they use. And this is actually something that I've struggled with over the years, because in one breath you're told, try not to say something too negative. And at the same time, you want to be honest and you want to be upfront and tell people what the scenario is. So for instance, somebody comes in, and I'll always remember in my early days, told to avoid saying something like, gosh, that must be really painful, because that just simply reinforces if the person trusts you and believes you. And let's say it wasn't painful. And then the story went that maybe the person went away and suddenly this thing became more painful because John said it must be. So there's obviously a placebo and a nocebo effect that's at play. No, the point I'm making to you is I'm simply bringing to your attention that it has been proposed, you know, by respected authorities that cancers have to start somewhere. We all have cancer cells in our bodies. And obviously, you know, a lot of this could be either genetic or epigenetic. In other words, it could be to do with the environment and it could be to do with lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. But they have to start somewhere. And one of the propositions, as I say, that was made was that the myofascial trigger points, based upon their neurochemistry, bradykinins and phosphate P, et cetera, prostaglandins and so on, that that this could be the precursor. In other words, this could be the earliest genesis of cancer cells. And as I mentioned to you, the work of Jay Shah, who works for the National Institutes of Health, I think it's, you know, it's gold standard research. So I think it's worthwhile knowing that. And I suppose what that basically says is that if you are treating myofascial trigger points, that the premise is that you could be doing more good than you realize in terms of treating people within your community. On the other hand, I'm also pointing out to you that there are times when myofascial trigger points perhaps should not be treated. In other words, they could be playing a functional role. So this is part of the conversation that we have to get into as well, so that you can make an informed choice on behalf of your patients and clients.
Thank you very much, John. Yeah, there was also, I didn't mention in the therapy mix there, there's obviously some people that are starting out and others that are way more advanced. So the course will cover both. And there are a lot of people in there, keep posting now their specialisms in neuromuscular therapy and work like that. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to use a video presentation on the physiology side of things. And the beauty of that is that you'll be able to go back and look at this over and over again. So for those people who are more advanced, you'll probably feel a lot more comfortable with it from the word go. And for those people who are new to it, you're going to be blown away and you're going to go, oh my gosh. So don't let that worry you, because it is about repetition. It's about going back over it and stopping it from time to time and maybe make a few notes and go away and come back to it again and watch it again. This is something that is going to take a little bit of time, but the beauty of doing a course like this is that it's not just about hearing it the once and now you're gone. And now you've no way of going back to hear it a second time unless you pay to do the course again. That's not the way this works. You can now come back to embodied health and you can listen to it as often and as many times as you need to. I would suggest you do it in small digestible chunks because that seems to help the learning process far greater than trying to do everything all in one sitting.
Yeah, it's also good to add, because we've had a lot of new audience since COVID, which we're grateful for, and we're happy to reach more people, that all our videos are recorded, apart from supervision and private team meetings, but all our webinars and courses are recorded, and you can download the podcast to listen to offline. And then when you need to look at visuals, you can refer to the videos at any time. And they're all now with chapters, so you can search when John changes topic onto another area. You'll be able to find that in the menu on our site. We host our videos on Vimeo, and it now allows you to put in chapters, so they're searchable and navigable that way. So yeah,
and it's essential, by the way, for movement teachers to know that although this particular presentation is obviously going to focus on manual interventions, please know that this is a course that's going to be informative to both manual and to movement therapists. It really is. I mean, there's a lot of the information I think that you're going to find very, very useful. You may not use some of the manual techniques or some of the manual diagnostic assessment techniques that I'll demonstrate, but that doesn't mean to say that the course won't be of benefit and that you won't come away with additional knowledge. I think you will. And that's why we've priced it at the 60 euros, so that hopefully it'll be affordable for everybody, so hopefully it will prove to be successful in that regard. And that's what we're hoping for anyway. So tell your friends, share the information with your colleagues, and let's get as many people involved as possible.
Thank you very much, John. And thank you everyone for attending. All the details are in the links to this video and in the links I've shared here below and in the chat. So thank you for your questions and we'll see you next week, John.
Great. Thanks, Julie. Thanks, John.
Thank you. you very much, Don. Thank you. Wonderful.
Bye, everyone.
Good night. Thank you.